This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. If you want to look around, take an inventory of all the stuff, all that stuff that makes up your world, your ceramic coffee cup, glass windows, paper magazines and books, a plastic pen, the sleek aluminum and glass of your smartphone, and embedded within it, silicon, of course, but also rare minerals like indium and europium. Just as our ancestors were defined by the materials they used, you had the Stone Age, the Bronze Age, the Iron Age. We are now products of the Silicon Age. And maybe next, who knows, the Graphene Age. The stories behind how all these materials were made. Did you know that stainless steel was an accident? Yeah, you will. Or that concrete never completely dries? Well, all these stories are fascinatingly explained in the book Stuff Matters, Exploring the Marvelous Materials That Shape Our Man-Made World. What would we do? What would we do without all this stuff? Well, Mark Miodovnik is the author of Stuff Matters. He's also director of the Institute of Making at University College London, professor of materials and society there. Welcome to Science Friday, Dr. Miodovnik.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Stuff matters. It's got all kinds of stuff that we use. You have covered my favorite stuff. You have concrete, glass, ceramics, all kinds of stuff like that. What was your favorite material that you decided would become that one when you wrote the book?
Well, it's funny you should say that, because obviously the materials that we made as civilizations, you know, this is who we are. You take all the materials away, everything is made from something. And so what we're left with is you know, we're naked in a field. That's it. So a lot of who we are is the materials around us. So each chapter I wrote, I thought, oh, this is the material. This is the one that really, really defines us. But as I went through the book, I realized that, you know, each one of those materials reflects a different aspect of our personality as humans. And you can't really single one of them out as kind of us. Mm. And also people have different affinities to different materials. Some people, as you say, I hope you said, love concrete. Other people love silk, or they love gold. Right. And that love, you know, that's what I was trying to get at in this book, which is that, you know, that love comes of a history of us creating these materials and creating stuff out of these materials.
Let's talk about some of the interesting stuff in your book. You write in the book that metals are actually crystals, really.
Yeah, I mean, that is one of the most surprising things about metals, is that you may think that they're this kind of amalgam of atoms, metallic atoms, and if you give it any thought at all, you think, well, they must have electrons in there and a few other things. But the fact that they are crystals, billions and billions and billions of crystals, and those crystals act like little machines inside the metal. So not only are metals made of crystals, but those crystals do things. And it's the doing that makes metals so perfect for tools. And without that property, without metals having that ability, it's very unlikely we would have developed civilization at all.
What do you mean, do things? Give us a little more detail on that.
Well, so when you bend a coat hanger, right, you're going to try and use the coat hanger for something, unblock a drain or something.
Right.
That coat hanger is made of crystals. As you bend it, what are those crystals doing? Are they bending? Which is a strange thing for a crystal to do, because we think of crystals as these, you know, regular arrangement of atoms that all have, you know, all have the same atoms next to them. And if they're bending, how are they bending? Are they like elastic? And it turns out that neither is true. They're not bending. They rearrange themselves in real time. They move atoms from one side of the crystal to the other. And they do that so fast that the crystal state remains there, but the crystal changes shape into the bent shape. Now, that is truly amazing. And it's that capacity to do that which makes metals the perfect materials for tools, because if that was a piece of glass, it would have snapped in your hand. If that was a wood, it would snap probably in your hand. If it was, you know, if it's a rock, you know, it's hard, but it's not going to bend. Here you're having something that is as hard as rock, but can be bent. And it's all to do with these crystals inside the metals.
Now, you just explained something to me that I could never understand before, which I knew was how it worked. I know that when you bend a metal, if you bend that coat hanger, or if you bend a spoon or a fork, you can never bend it back to its original shape when you try to bend it backwards, because you're saying it's changed its position.
Yeah, you fundamentally change the internal structure of the material, the crystal structure. And And what you can do, and this is also explained something, I don't know if you've ever played around, but if you put that spoon or coat hanger in a hot fire, it will change its strength. So, because if you bend something, you'll notice it gets hot, and right. and the heat is these little machines inside the metal crystals working. So that's where the heat comes from, and then it gets stronger, right? It's harder to bend it back. But if you put it in a fire, it goes back to being soft again. Now, what's happening is that inside these crystals, these little machines called dislocations, get all tangled up. And when you put them in the fire, that gives them enough energy to untangle. And that makes the metal softer. I mean, it makes the crystal easier mm-hmm. to move around.
Is that why blacksmiths always heat up things, you know, like horseshoes when they want to? Are they shaping it and molding it? Or a swordsman, you always see they heat the sword up? I had heard that actually by banging it with another hammer or something, you're actually strengthening the material itself.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And that so you hit a metal and it gets harder. How can that be? Well, you're changing the structure of these little machines inside the crystals, these dislocations, and you're making more of them. And they interact with each other and they find it harder to move. And because they find it harder to move, that makes the metal harder. Hmm. And if you want to make it easier to move, which is what the blacksmith is doing when he heats up a metal, he's trying to make it softer to deform. So he's heating them up and they then untangle, and then that makes it easier even to move. So when you hit things with hammers and put them in the furnace, you're actually manipulating down to the atomic structure of these crystals.
Hmm. Very interesting. You write in your book, speaking now that we're talking about swords, you write about samurai swords. And what makes them special materials?
I mean, what I find most incredible about the metal story of our civilization, and metals really are the key to lots of things, is that the samurai, the Japanese, were making steel as good as we can make it now. And they were making it without any understanding of these crystals or their internal structure or atoms in general. And how did they do that? Because actually, when you look at our very sophisticated steels that we make for things like, you know, your car or a bridge, then inside them are various different layers of structure, the manipulation of these crystals, which is incredibly sophisticated. And we can do it because we have, you know, sophisticated tools and electron microscopes, and we have, you know, quantum theory to understand it all. They had their hands and a hammer. But they still got there. And that, right. that tells you something very remarkable about our ancestors, which is that they had skill in their hands. They could feel different structures inside the metal. They also used the sound and the smell of these things to really get to the point where they had optimized steel.
And they also, our ancestors, must have been very observant, because think about the first person who discovered what metal was and what you could do with it. He had no one to tell him what to do, right? I mean...
Yeah,
how did you discover you could do these things with it?
I really think it's an amazing thought. When you think back to the fact that without metals, really, essentially, civilization just doesn't happen. But someone had to work out that you could take some rocks, put them in a fire, under the right conditions, they became liquid metal. Can you imagine that moment? Yeah. And then to look around you and look around your environment and think, oh, my God, those rocks, which rocks give me what? Because not all rocks work. And they had to work it all out. And they did it without a laboratory. Right. They did it without science.
And then somebody discovered, you know, if I add a little bit of this shiny zinky thing into the metal, I've created an alloy. Right?
Yeah. There's a mystery there too, as you say, because some alloys are much, much stronger. And they had to work it out by trial and error. And they must have handed down that information, you know, through the generations. It wasn't written down. And so that would have meant that the people who could do that, the people who really knew which rocks to get and what fires to make, they were so valuable. They were the most valuable people.
And what do the alloys, why are alloys stronger than just the pure metal itself?
Well, I mean, it comes back to these little machines I was saying that are the crystals, the metal crystals, is that when you understand that a metal is, you know, lots of these little crystals interacting with each other, then if you can get in the way of the way that they deform, that they move atoms from one side to the other, if you can stop that process, you make the metal harder. You make it, you know, you make it less easy to bend. So when you put an alloy element into it, it slots in to the crystal structure, but it's a different size, and it also has different electron valency, so it disturbs that process and it makes it harder for these little electron, I mean atom movements to happen.
That's why you hardly ever see pure gold. Not that it's not more valuable, but it's so soft and pliable without having some impurity in it to strengthen it.
Yeah, you wouldn't want pure gold jewelry because it would scratch so easily.
Yeah. Let's talk about, I mentioned before that I think I'm the only person in the world that really enjoys knowing and talking about concrete.
Great.
Let's talk. You know, the first thing I learned in this business a long time ago, and I've been doing this quite a while, is never to confuse cement and concrete, because the civil engineers get on my case when you do that. Because concrete is the product and cement is one of the ingredients, right?
Right. I mean, concrete's a composite material. It has all sorts of things in it. One of it is aggregate, these little stones, and the other is reinforcement in the form of steel bars. And the whole thing comes together as a material that really is very sophisticated indeed, and it works on so many levels.
Yeah. Is it true that it never finishes drying out? It's always drying forever?
Well, it doesn't dry. That's the thing. When you add water to this concrete mix, right, actually you're starting a chemical reaction between the water and the cement. And so the reason the water goes away is not because it evaporates or dries. It's because it becomes a gel, actually. And then the gel hardens with these fibrils that form, and it forms basically stone again. So the water is inside the stone, and that it becomes part of the concrete. And it does it for years. I mean, that reaction carries on for years.
I love it. So the concrete's still there, sort of with the water in it, even the Roman aqueducts that have been up for 2,000 years.
Yep. Well, I mean, the Pantheon is a 2,000-year-old, you know, unreinforced concrete structure that the Romans built, and it's still up.
Is it true that concrete can be self-healing also?
Yeah, so there's a new form of concrete, self-healing concrete, you'll be glad to know. And it works in a very ingenious way. There's bacteria that are put inside the concrete, and they lie dormant for years. They can lie dormant for 50 years.
No, you're making this up.
No. And when a crack opens and that bacteria is exposed to the air and the damp air, they wake up and they look around for food like we all do in the morning. And they find it because there's also been starch put into this concrete mix. And they eat the starch and they poo. And they poo calcite, which is one of the major constituents of concrete. And they eat their way out of the crack and they leave a fully, you know, formed piece of concrete behind them. And they can restore 90% of the strength of the concrete.
I'm speechless. Not often I am. That's a new kind of concrete. How long will those bacteria survive? Will they last forever in there, or is there a lifetime?
So they can survive inside the concrete for about 50 years.
Right.
Of course, when they've eaten their way out of that crack, I mean, it won't self-heal forever. And I think that, obviously, those are the things that researchers like me and others, you know, try and solve, which is, you know, You create new materials, they do a job, but you're always striving to make them better.
Right. Wow.
But I do believe that the infrastructure, our buildings, our bridges, our roads, in 20, 30 years' time, those structures will be more animate. They will be more sentient. They will have probably sensors in them, and they will also heal themselves.
This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow from PRI, Public Radio International. Let's talk about, I mentioned before that stainless steel was really an accident. Tell us about that.
Yeah, well, stainless steel is this a wonderful material. I mean, I bet every one of the listeners today has had a piece of stainless steel in their mouth already today. Because actually, it's the material we're so intimate with. You know, it's in the form of our spoon for our cereal in the morning, your knives and forks. And yet, it's made of iron. And it doesn't taste of anything. It, if you really suck a stainless steel spoon, you will find it's very hard to get any taste out of it at all.
Right.
And that was an accident. That was a guy called Harry Brearley in Sheffield, a very famous place for making steel. And he was trying to develop new alloys for guns. And he was just adding in, he had some idea of what might work. And he was adding in different alloy constituents, testing them to see if it was harder than the last alloy. And if it wasn't, he threw them in the corner. And he was doing this day in, day out, day in, day out. And one day he came into his lab. He looked at this pile of rusting specimens. And one of them wasn't rusting. And that, you know, a lot of discoveries of materials are accidents, but also they require someone to know
right.
that that's special and don't, right. and not walk away and go to the pub, but actually think, my God, what did I put in that?
Right.
And he realized that he put chromium in there and he basically discovered stainless steel.
Mm-hmm.
And the stainless steel that we all eat from and use every day is a miracle material because it has a coating on it, which is a sort of nickel chromium coating. And that coating is transparent, so although you can't see it, it looks fully metallic. It's actually an oxide on the surface.
Oh, no,
and when you put it in your mouth, a bit of your tooth will brush against it and will rub a bit of that oxide off and expose the new iron to the air. But before the iron can rust, chromium atoms will jump in and form the oxide back again. So this thing self-heals. It's a self-healing coating. You can have stainless steel cutlery for your whole life and it won't let you down. And it's made eating without tasting your cutlery something that everybody can do. Before stainless steel came along, basically only kings and queens and rich people, right, could do right. that. They had, you know, silver and gold, you know, cutlery. And everyone else had to eat out of, you know, iron and pewter and wood. And
right.
so it's an amazing thing. We are, you know, we are recipients of a genuine miracle. And I always joke with people, like, sometimes you go around to people's houses and they'll, on Christmas Day, they will get out their silver cutlery to you know, because it's a special day.
Right.
But actually, silver tastes quite a bit, especially with yes. acidic food like tomato. So I say to them, put the silver cutlery away, get the stainless steel out. It's much more special and it's much more inert. And use the silver cutlery every day for the normal stuff.
Right.
But when I come around, bring out the special stuff.
Give me that stainless steel. Well, we have to take a break. When we come back, we're going to talk lots more about our material world with Mark Miodobnik, author of Stuff Matters, Exploring the Marvelous Materials That Shape Our Man-Made World. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. We're talking this hour about the materials that make up our world, metals, concrete, glasses, all the stuff around you, with my guest, Mark Miodobnik. He is author of Stuff Matters, also director of the Institute of Making at University College London, professor of materials and society there. Let's move on to another fascinating. There's so much great stuff in the book. I don't know where to start or end. How about glass? Glass is really unusual in its own right, is it not?
It's so special. I mean, it's a transparent material, which it's very hard to understand how the car, for instance, a car would ever really have taken off, because anyone who's driven without a windscreen for any kind of, at any speed realizes that it's just not viable. You get so much stuff in your face, and mm-hmm. but you need something very hard. If you try and put like a plastic as a windscreen, it very, very soon gets milky and cloudy and scratched. So glass is this very hard material, but it lets light through. And that is very rare in the world of things that can do that.
How does it do that? Why does it do that?
Yeah, so then we have to sort of think about how can light go through some materials and not others?
Right.
And what does light do when it hits a material? And clearly, you know, actually when you think about atoms, and everything is made of atoms, there is the inside of it is a nucleus and then these electrons on the outside. When you analyze that structure, you realize it's mostly empty space. So in a way, the question is not why is glass transparent, but why isn't everything transparent? Because the chances of light going through it seem to be quite high. It's mostly empty space, an atom.
Right.
And so what it is that light is actually an electromagnetic wave and it interacts with the electrons inside these materials. And if the wavelength of that light, if the energy of that light, can make one of the electrons inside a material change to a different state, then it will absorb that light. And that's really what most matter can do. Most matter has these available electron states, which light is absorbed and there it becomes heat. But glass has no such states available. So it's a material in which when the light comes through the atoms and the molecules, it can't find any way to be absorbed. There is no mechanism. And so it just passes straight through. And that's why it's transparent.
Wow, it sounds easy when you say it, but it's still hard to wrap your mind around it, I think.
It is hard. And you know, obviously you can play with that, right? So you can say, actually, I want it mostly not to have these electron states in there, but I'm going to put a few in there. And what does that mean? It means I've colored the glass. It will absorb the red, let's say, or it'll absorb the blue. And so you get colored glass. And that was a very big moment in the Middle Ages, because glass obviously was the first time the window, for instance, means, you know, a place the wind comes through. So when glass comes along, it finally allows people to have lodgings, have buildings in which the wind and the rain aren't coming through, but they lets the light through. Mm-hmm. But then what happens is people start playing around with the colours and they realise they can make stained glass. And actually it changes worship. It changes how people, you know, cathedrals are born. They become palaces of light. Imagine, you know, temples and places of worship without stained glass and glass. They would be dark places, you know. It really changes quite a lot of how people practice their lives.
Mm-hmm. And you also talk about the different ways of making glass and the different materials used to make different kinds of glass and how important it is to choose the right one, or how they were experimented with early on to find out what worked.
Yeah, I mean, one of the fascinating stories about glass is that it's nurtured in the West because of its optical qualities. And people realize not only that can you make a window out of it, and not only can you make a glass out of it, which are wonderful things, but that you can shape it and make a lens. Now, once you have a lens, you can magnify things. So anyone listening to this who wears glasses realizes that without the lens, they would, you know, not function very well in life. But that was the fate of our ancestors until not that long ago. And, of course, if you put two lenses together next to each other, you have a pair of glasses. You put them one, down a tube, you have a telescope. And the telescope was the piece of equipment that allowed Galileo and subsequent astronomers to realize that it isn't the sun that goes around the Earth, it's the Earth that goes around the sun. And, you know, astrophysics as a subject becomes possible because of glass. And there's just no doubt about that. But then you turn it around, you make the microscope. And actually, without the microscope, really, biology doesn't exist. How can you know about microbes? How can you know about cells without magnification? You need glass. It's the only material that can do it. So biology relies on glass. And then you go to a chemistry lab, and what do you find? You find test tubes and all these things, and they're all made of glass. So that subject wouldn't exist either without glass. So you think of a simple material like glass, you think, oh, well, you know, it's nice, you know, we can see through it. But actually, From the perspective of science, so much of modern science wouldn't exist without that material.
Hmm. And if your society or culture never discovered or got into glass, you lost out on all of that.
Yeah, and there are some people who say that's what happened in the East, right? Because the Chinese and the Japanese and the Koreans never developed monolithic glass to any great extent. And although they were way ahead of the West technologically for a long, long, long time, they didn't have a kind of scientific enlightenment period, and it could well be that it's because they didn't have glass lenses. So they never developed the telescope, the microscope, and chemistry and all that.
Very interesting. Let's talk about bioglass. What is bioglass?
Yeah, so bioglass is a form of glass. It was developed by an American called Larry Hench, and he was a surgeon in the Vietnam War, and he was very disturbed at the number of amputations that were having to be done, and he wanted to give people, you know, he wanted to do something about that. And he wanted to find a bone replacement material that could, you know, that could be put into patients. And he developed a type of glass which, when cells, and especially stem cells, sit on it, they turn into bone. And that sounds science fiction, but it's It's true. And in fact, that material, that was in the 1960s. So that material has become very, very kind of mature now. And there are many, many people who've benefited from that. If you go and have surgery now, it's very likely you'll be given some of this if you're replacing some sort of bone or some sort of implant.
Very interesting. Yeah. You have a chapter on carbon, which can take the form of anything from graphite to diamonds to buckyballs. And we now have this new form called graphene. What do you think about graphene as it relates to the other forms of carbon? We still have a problem making it, don't we?
Yeah, I mean, I think graphene is a wonder material. It's one of those materials that looks like it's going to completely shape the 21st century and change so much of the way we do things. But yet, it hasn't really proved itself to be amenable to kind of industrialization yet. Mm-hmm. And that is the key. And if you look back at silicon was a material which material scientists developed in the early 20th century. They knew, actually, from theory, that you ought to be able to make a transistor out of it.
Right.
And it took them a long time to work out how to manipulate the crystals of silicon to make them pure enough, and then to alloy them, actually, and give you the right properties. And it turned out that silicon is industrializable. I mean, that's why we all have mobile phones and computers. I mean, that's the thing that makes it possible. And it's not quite clear yet that graphene is. But it may. But, in the case of silicon, it took, 10, 20, 30 years. So things happen faster now. But I think people should, don't hold their breath. It'll probably be 10 years before graphene really makes a big impact on your life.
Yeah. Are there any materials that we're running out of that we should be worried about?
Well, okay. So, I mean, the thing about humanity is it's, we have a lot of materials. We've managed to extract them from the earth. And there are lots of them that are, carry a high price and are kind of relatively rare. I very much doubt we're going to run out of any of them, because the amount of Earth's crust there is that we haven't even explored yet is enormous. What will stop us doing it, I think, and create shortages is actually two things. One is whether energy becomes more and more expensive or not, and that's a big question. If energy becomes more expensive, then getting stuff out of the ground and making it into different materials will become more difficult. And the other is that our completely lackluster approach to recycling materials, which maybe it's just been born of, coming out of a 20th century where we were just so excited about new things that we didn't really care about what we did with the old stuff. But I think we're going to have to change that attitude now, because mm-hmm. we're throwing away stuff that's very valuable and also, deserves better. I mean, that's the thing I feel most strongly about recycling, is not so much that, okay, there's this amount of zinc in there and there's this amount of copper and there's this amount of platinum. Right. But actually that we spent a great deal of effort discovering what those elements were, finding out what they did, making this amazing stuff that people use in their houses and their homes and their aeroplanes. And then to throw it in a landfill seems to me to be, mm-hmm. it doesn't say very good things about our culture. I think we need to learn how to unmake things.
But we're also losing things we can't get back that we can't recycle, like helium, right?
Yeah, well, the helium is a special case. Helium we're definitely going to run out of if we're not careful. And that we should be much more we should be worried about, because helium escapes into space. It's light enough that when you pop a party balloon, that helium makes its way up into the upper atmosphere and in the end into space, and we leave a trail of helium as we go around the sun. And helium is incredibly useful. It's party balloons is a trivial use for the material, because actually it's used to cool MRI machines and CAT scanners in hospitals, and that's an immense, it's very hard to replace it for that. Mm-hmm. And we don't have an enormous amount of helium on the earth. It's created in the Earth's core by a nuclear fission of some heavy elements. It works its way up through volcanic eruptions and through into kind of natural gas, actually. And so it's the people who get natural gas out of the ground who are the ones who can recover the helium. And it's not going to be long before the Middle East is the biggest producer of helium, actually.
Wow. So you're saying Don't fill up those party balloons with helium.
I think you should never use that material for party balloons. That material should be used for hospitals. And if you want a party balloon that looks jolly and floats, then use hydrogen, which is actually much more exciting anyway, because you can then, at the end of the party, you just light a match and it goes bang.
Pop.
And who doesn't want that? Whereas helium doesn't do that at all.
Well, Mark, this book is fantastic. You know, I love the history of science. I love how things are made, and it's all here in Mark's book, Stuff Matters, Exploring the Marvelous Materials That Shape Our Man-Made World. And thank you for taking time to be with us today, Mark.
Thank you very much. It's been lovely.
Mark Miodovnik is the author of Stuff Matters. He's also director of the Institute of Making at University College London and professor of materials and society there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you.